Hi, and this is the Physics High Podcast. A quick quiz. Do you A, want to be inspired by science communicators? B, want to learn all about science education? C, want guidance on your scientific journey? Well, how about D, all of the above? Today, my guest is Dr. Claire Lee. Now, Claire is originally from South Africa and works for Fermilab as an experimental physicist. But since 2011, she's been based at CERN in Geneva, Switzerland, where she was involved with the ATLAS experiment. Now, you may have heard of ATLAS. ATLAS is one of the detectors at the Large Hadron Collider, responsible for the discovery of the Higgs boson, which was announced in 2012. Now, she currently is working with DUNE, which is the Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment. Now, not only is she an exceptional experimental physicist, she's a fantastic science communicator. Now, I had the pleasure of actually hearing that firsthand when she presented at the International High School Teachers Program at CERN in 2019. But she's also communicated science in a number of interesting ways, including being a Jedi Master and singing Little Mermaid. Needless to say, she is not your stereotypical experimental physicist, but that's a very good thing. Welcome, Claire.
Thank you very much. That's an awesome introduction.
So tell us a little bit. I've given a bit of introduction to our audience about what you do. Do you want to fill us a bit more what you do, particularly what is an experimental physicist, and particularly, I guess, your current work with DUNE?
Sure. Okay, so an experimental particle physicist, well, an experimental physicist, is basically a physicist who does experiments, works on experiments, and who uses experiments to determine the nature of reality, which is different to a theoretical physicist. A theoretical physicist is somebody who uses mathematics to build up models that could potentially describe reality. And you need both experimental physicists and theoretical physicists together to do their work and then to compare results, because you need the theorists to come up with all sorts of different possibilities for the model of the universe. And then you need to compare those to reality, to the results that you get in experiments. And then the experiments will tell you which of those models are correct or not. So I work on the experimental side. I look at the results that we get from particle physics experiments. And that lets us tell, that tells us about what the universe is like right here, right now, in these situations that we are creating, be it inside collisions at the LHC or in other types of particle experiments around the world. So as you said, I did my PhD on ATLAS, and I worked as a postdoc on the ATLAS experiment for a number of years, which was really, really awesome. And as of March last year, I decided that it was time for a bit of a change. So I've switched from collider type of particle physics to neutrino particle physics. So this is the field of neutrino physics is really exciting right now. There's a lot of experiments currently going on, and there's a very exciting neutrino experiment called DUNE, which is under construction right now, which will send a beam of muon flavor neutrinos from Fermilab in the United States underground for 1,300 kilometers to South Dakota, to a different lab, Sanford Lab, in South Dakota, where there will be a bunch of detectors waiting to pick up these neutrinos as they arrive. And the way these neutrinos arrive, what flavor they are when they arrive, because neutrinos change flavor in very specific ways, which is really interesting. This is also going to tell us some really interesting things about the universe and the laws of the universe that we live in today. So that's really exciting. What I've been doing for DUNE, it's a huge, big experiment. And usually with these type of things, you need to be sure that what you're building is actually going to work. So what they've actually done is the DUNE detectors are going to be really, really huge underground detectors filled with liquid argon. And here at CERN, they've built prototypes of these detectors. So for the last couple of years, we've had 10 by 10 by 10 cubic meter vats full of liquid argon, looking at neutrinos coming from the from a beamline in CERN. And they've been using that to really learn how these detectors work, what are some of the advantages of doing things in a particular way, and some of the potential disadvantages. And we're now at the stage of revamping the ideas a little bit, tweaking the ideas that worked really well, maybe changing something else. And one of the things that I'm working on is a new idea for the structure of the detector, looking at just the different setups that we could use for this and which set, which particular design setup may work better under different circumstances.
What you're sharing here, what I find fascinating is the fact that there's a lot of collaboration going in here. You're working on, you're working with Fermilab on a lab that's being built in the States, but you're still based at CERN. So, and there's still, so there's really, the real world of physics really is a very collaborative, international collaborative affair, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, these type of experiments we're doing, they're so huge that it's too big for, like, not even one person, it's too big for one country to be able to build and host on their own. You need the commitment from hundreds or of countries or tens of countries around the world, hundreds of institutes around the world, thousands of people around the world need to be working on this, you know, to actually make it happen. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's really great because it is, as you say, global. It's less great when you have meetings that start at like 7 a.m. or 7 p.m. or whatever, because that's less fun. But, you know, it's really nice. And I think it's important as well as a form of building community and unity across the globe.
So tell us the audience a little bit about why we are wanting to know more about neutrinos and the color change as they pass through the Earth. I mean, I guess some people may listen and say, why spend all that money? I guess it's the same question why we collide protons in the Large Hadron Collider, and I've addressed that in some of my videos. Tell me, what is the thing that drives you in terms of why you want to look more at neutrinos?
Okay, so first of all, you said color changing. It's actually flavor changing, but I will get to that.
My apologies. Yeah.
No problem. So I think that there are two fundamental points for me. If you just take practicality aside, because, you know, whenever we have breakthroughs or whenever we make steps in understanding the universe, there is always some technology that comes possibly decades later from this understanding, but it comes, right? But that aside, I think that there are two fundamental reasons to be doing fundamental research. And the first one is, I think it's just part of our nature as humans, right? It's the same reason why people climb to the top of Everest, right? It's this need to push boundaries and to explore and to go further than, you know, humans have ever gone before. So I think that just doing these experiments is a very fundamental and important part of what makes us human, full stop. The second point is, it's important to understand the universe that we live in and why it even exists. We actually don't know why we are even here right now, because when the Big Bang happened, equal amounts of matter and antimatter were created, because, you know, there's a conservation law that says that you can't create something from nothing. It has to balance out. So matter and antimatter had to balance right after the Big Bang. And then what ended up happening is matter and antimatter, if they met up with each other again, they would annihilate in a puff of energy. So you would think that if you had equal amounts of matter and antimatter to start, and then they annihilated, then you would be left with no matter and antimatter at all. But somehow we actually, well, just the fact that we exist, we live in a universe that is made of matter. That all of the stars and everything that you see, this is all matter. This is leftover matter, which, if there was this balance, shouldn't be here. So like, we shouldn't even be here and we don't understand why. And scientists, physicists have been trying to figure this out for many, many years. And one of the things that they think is that the type of particles that neutrinos are, these are called leptons. The way that leptons work may shed some insight into this asymmetry between matter and antimatter. There's a possibility that if neutrinos and antineutrinos don't work in exactly the same way, that can build up enough of an asymmetry to over 13.8 billion years, give us the universe that we have today. Mm. So that is why it's really exciting.
No, that's fantastic. I totally agree. I mean, it's just, yeah, as you said, we are an inquiring species who wants to explore, whether it's Vasco da Gama going around the world, Neil Armstrong landing on the moon. Yeah, absolutely. It's just the continuation of that story. I want to change the tack a little bit, and I want to ask the question as to why you got in science. And my understanding, Michael Crichton had something to do with it. A little bit different.
It did. I mean, okay, so, you know, as a kid, I was always interested in this sort of thing. I loved, my parents took me to the planetarium, which I loved. We went so often. And I think, you know, when I was like younger, I wanted to be either an astronaut or an archaeologist. And then, you know, then as I was growing up, you sort of like wonder what you're going to do when you're in middle school. And then I think I was around 16 or so. And I read that book Sphere by Michael Crichton. And it was a cool story, but the biggest thing for me was the fact that there was an astrophysicist who was one of the characters in the book. And I thought to myself that astrophysicist had to be just about the coolest job title in the entire world. So I decided then and there that I was going to go to university and study astrophysics. So I did. You know, I went, I finished my school. I did physics and maths and biology and stuff in high school. And then I went to university and I started studying physics and maths and applied maths. And then, you know, in third year, I think it was, we had to do some projects. So I was like, astrophysics time. And I went and spoke to some people about doing some astrophysics projects. And one of the projects was on pulsars, which was really cool because pulsars are amazing. They're these collapsed stars that rotate really quickly and send a beam of light like a lighthouse. And they rotate really fast and they're super predictable. You can set clocks by them. And you can learn a lot about the astrophysics of stars by studying them. But, you know, I did the project. I didn't feel like I was really probing the nature of the universe, which is really what I wanted to do. And so in my fourth year, I actually ended up working on an experimental nuclear physics project with my lecturer who ended up becoming my master's and my PhD advisor. And that was where everything just sort of started clicking for me during this nuclear physics project. I then went on to do my a high energy nuclear physics thesis for my master's and then took it up a notch for high energy physics for my PhD. But yeah, no, that's really kind of how it happened. It's a little bit of stubbornness, you know, as well, of deciding that that's what I want to be and, you know, just that's it, I'm going to do this. And then just kind of going with the flow from then on.
Your story actually reminds me of something I attended today. The Perimeter Institute hosted for the International Year for Women in Science, a Q&A. A number of the presenters talked about and encouraging students about those who are thinking about science careers, about the fact that your road isn't set when you leave high school. The fact is you can go so many paths, and I've spoken to a number of people now with the podcast as well, that, you know, there's so many options and it's okay to change. And I love the fact that you had this complete passion for astrophysics and then right at the end, like, I want to do something on the small scale. I just like that, you know. And you shared before too, you know, oh, Atlas, oh, I've had enough of that. I'm now going to neutrinos, which is, again, a completely different area too. And I think you're following your passion, really, isn't that the case?
Yeah. I think, you know, you've got to have some like dedication to the course, but also you can't allow yourself to set your identity by that, which I think is a big thing in academia in general, is people often tie their identity to the type of thing that they're doing. And then if you need to move away for whatever reason, maybe it's just not giving you enough passion anymore, or, you know, maybe it is, but the job market is so completely saturated. So I think it's an important thing to love what you do, but also to not be totally, you've got to recognize that you are a person besides what you do, which I think is quite important. Mm-hmm.
I guess a key part for your role is not only experimental physics, but also communicating. I mean, if you're a scientist, you're a communicator of science as well. How important do you see your role in terms of science communication?
Well, I think that science communication is extremely important just in general. I mean, one of the biggest problems I think the world has today is that we are living in a society where there's this culture where, you know, it's like ignorance is cool. And you know, in today's day and age where you have information at your fingertips with the internet, and you know, there are so many people available that you can reach out to and ask if you need any information at all, that's actually really concerning for me, that first of all, you know, this you know, it's cool to be ignorant, it's cool to not care, and also this it's concerning that, you know, there's this culture of like anti-expertise, right? So people think that, yeah, okay, you know, they do a little bit of Googling and read, you know, some random web page that confirms their views on vaccinations or whatever, rather than believing the expertise of thousands of scientists around the world. And, you know, this is really worrying, because in some cases it's just frustrating, but in other cases, as we have seen over the past year with this pandemic, it can be downright dangerous. So as scientists, fine, not everyone is good at communication, but science in general has an obligation to make sure that things are communicated well. And to nurture communication skills within their scientific field as well.
What are the possible solutions to that? Like, what are the ideas in terms of raising scientific literacy? I mean, is it something that we need to concentrate at the governmental level? Is it something that we need to concentrate as educators both? I guess I'm just curious into what your opinions are in terms of raising literacy within society.
So much of this really does start at the home. I mean, if you have a kid who's living in an anti-science household, there is only so much that you as teachers and the government can do. So it really is, it's a really fundamental problem at many levels as well. And I think, well, I mean, The problem is that it's also a long scale problem to solve, because what you're fighting now is culture that was ingrained. For example, for me, I mean, I was a kid 30 odd years ago. So, you know, and now I'm using those experiences to deal with the now. So it really is this very, very long-term thing, and you're not going to see results immediately. I think another thing that people need to be careful of is, you know, it was the International Day of Women in Science yesterday, and people are like, we must do this to inspire like girls' interests in science. And I think that is actually the incorrect message to have, because girls are interested in science. What you need to do is fight the systemic barriers that prevent women and girls from continuing and staying in science, which is a lot more difficult than having a one-day show, like science showcase. Let's have some people come and chat to my class about, you know, what it's like to do science. So I think that the problem is a lot more deep-rooted than many of these. They're not necessarily like many things just target, let's do awareness, let's, you know, do interest. And I mean, we've had that for many, many years now. We now need to go a step beyond. And so for me personally, I think, well, I don't know. I've always just been good at talking about this sort of thing. So it just so happened that I started doing public talks, you know, more than 10 years ago at my university, at my astronomy society back in South Africa. I was giving talks a lot. And you know, this continued when I was over here. CERN started asking me to do talks and little videos and stuff for them. And you know, then it just grows like that. So for me, I've realized that I am good at this and I enjoy doing it. It gives me a lot of energy to do to do stuff like this. So therefore I do want to make this part of my career life type of thing. But also, you know, in terms of like having a public persona on Twitter or something. So my Twitter is a bit here and there. I haven't really settled on like a brand or something, but you know, I feel like that's okay too, because you know, I'm a human. I'm not only a thing. I've got many parts.
And yeah, a lover of cats, I noticed.
My cats are amazing, except at 4 a.m. when they like my one stupid cat, he comes on my head at 4 a.m. and just curls up right here and sleeps on my head, and it's adorable, but also it wakes me up at 4 a.m. every single day. So you know, I think like I try to just share my everyday-ish sort of life type of stuff. So, you know, people don't just see the science part of me, but they see like the whole package and they see the ups and the downs and all the stuff that you can also do if you are a scientist, right? You're not only supposed to be waking up, going to the lab, doing science and coming home and sleeping. There's a whole bunch more to life than that.
I think that's important. I mean, I know you don't do this because of what I'm about to say, because this is just you, who you are. But people need to see that scientists are just real people who have their own foibles and interests on the side. And it, I think, in some ways, one concern I've always had, and I think we agree on this, is that science, obviously, and scientists have had sort of almost an image problem. You know, you ask what does a scientist looks like, lab coat, wild hair is usually the thing that comes in their head, you know, and it's important to break that down so that, you know, people go, yeah, this is something I want to investigate. I'm curious about the world. And it isn't a nerdy thing. It's actually a cool thing. And there are lots of people who are very different who do science in different ways, such as yourself. So now that is a nice lead on to the question. Let's say you have a class of students who are possibly saying, hey, Claire, what advice would you give me if I'm considering either a degree in science or even going further, a career in science? What would your words be?
Cool. Okay. There is so much advice out there and so much advice that can be given. Let me see. I think, you know, it is a very personal decision, and it's a decision that it's a difficult decision. It's also a difficult field because it's a very long-term thing, right? It's not like you're going to go get a four-year degree and then go and get a job and start earning a bunch of money. So you're going to still be a student for many, many years while your friends from school are buying houses and settling down. Meanwhile, you know, you're going to probably be job hopping from one country to another country, if, especially if you're doing experimental type of stuff. So this is awesome, but it can also be difficult. For me, I did things a little bit weird because, you know, normally people think that, you know, you settle down and you have kids and you get married and blah, 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 like right sort of towards the end of everything. I kind of did this in the middle. I got married during my master's. I had my kid during my PhD, which was fantastic. But it was only possible because I had the support of my advisor who had done the same thing himself with his two kids when he was doing his PhD way back. And also, you know, I had the support of my husband and my family. When we moved over here to CERN, my kid was one. And we basically packed up our entire life in South Africa. My husband left his job. We left our entire family and we moved here to a place that we didn't speak the language. And it was just the two of us and our one-year-old kid on our own on like a really, really small salary of a PhD student. And there, and my husband stayed at home for 6 months being a stay-at-home dad for the first 6 months. And he said it was the hardest thing he's ever done. You know, I think that science is great, but you know, it is also important for people to realize that that these paths are difficult and long term, and in the end, it can be rewarding, but it takes quite a lot of commitment I was privileged to have a family who could support me and who could do this for me. Many people don't have that, which is also unfortunate. So this is another thing that people are also trying to fight is this imbalance the way it stands, there's a lot of privilege that goes into being able to do these things, which rule out many people from different areas of life. So, you know, these are things that need to be fought, and it's also just a thing to be aware of. But I think, if I have to give like one piece of advice, if you know, for people, is to have a hobby or a sport that you really enjoy, and continue on with that throughout your studying and throughout everything, because this is such a long-term process, you know, even now, right? Sitting down, working on an analysis, it takes years. It can take years to do an analysis, write a paper, get all the results and stuff, and then to finally get that published. A PhD will take years and years and years to do. So, and this is, you know, it's every day. There's a lot of effort that goes in with very little reward. So I think having a hobby or a sport is a lovely way for you to just necessarily break away from the science for a bit and have a break, but also to have something where you put in effort and you get an almost immediate reward. So for me, I run. I'm not good at running. Like, I'm not fast. It's difficult for me. But it is rewarding because, you know, every day I go for a run and I go for like an hour run and it's tough. But at the end of it, you have that boost of endorphins or whatever, and you feel good about yourself. And even if I spend the rest of this day staring at code that just is crashing and I make no progress on that, at least I've got something for that day that has given me a little bit of energy in return for the effort that I've put in. So I think something like that is, I think, you know, making sure that you have like something that brings you reward is actually very important just to maintain your own like mental and physical health throughout this sort of thing.
We now get to our last question. And my understanding is you're going to be sharing something Well, it's so sciencey. I'm really intrigued with what you want to share with us.
Okay, so yeah, I want to, I've never done this before, like on a video. So this is going to be your first time. It may or may not work. But okay, so I'm South African. And one very, very traditional South African dessert is something called melktert or milk tart. And it's actually one of the favorites of my family. And it's really easy to make. So I thought that I would take you guys down to my kitchen and try and do this in front of you guys and make some milk tart.
That's awesome. Okay.
When you said milk tart, I can understand it because I'm Dutch. So the Afrikaans are so, so similar. So I've never had it before. So I'm really, really keen to try it. And you're going to take it.
Hey, okay.
Okay. Hi. So now we're in my kitchen. And I am going to make something called milk tart, which is one of my family's favorite traditional South African desserts. It's really easy. You need just some milk, some flour, and a little bit of cinnamon for some flavor. And it really is like a custardy, sort of like a custardy, milky kind of cake type of thing. I've made it a few years ago. We had the Atlas Christmas party at CERN, so we had to bring dishes from all around the world. So I brought one of these, and it was a big hit. So yeah, now I tried it. Well, I don't actually make it as much as I should because it's so easy, but I figured let's try this today. So really, the biggest thing you need is milk. So you need 4.5 cups of milk, which I've got in a pot here. And that's on the stove at the moment, just coming to a boil. In the meantime, we're going to mix everything else in this other pot over here, and which we're going to pour the milk into and then do the rest of the baking. So all I've got here is I need 3 eggs. I'm putting that in. I've got, so we're going to just mix up the eggs. And then add 1 cup of sugar. I generally do a little bit less than a cup of sugar just because I don't need it to be so sweet. So add some sugar. And then I've got 2.5 tablespoons of corn flour, like maizena, and 2.5 tablespoons of regular flour, and a pinch of salt, which I've put in there together. So really what you just want to do is mix all that up until you've got it kind of smooth over here. Put that milk back to boil. So you can see it's very creamy, very smooth, and most importantly, no lumps over here. And the one other thing that my recipe doesn't say, but I like to do, is add some cinnamon into the mixture itself. You often decorate by putting some cinnamon on top, but I like the flavor that adding cinnamon inside as well gives. So now that's ready. What I'm gonna do is wait for the milk to come to a boil, and it is almost boiling. Oh, look, let me just do that now. You guys can see. You have to be very careful with watching milk boil because it does nothing, nothing, nothing. And then all of a sudden it like goes completely over. So you just need to be a little bit careful when the milk gets to the almost boiling stage. And we're almost there. And here we go. So it's just about to boil. So I'm just going to pour it in there and then you mix. Just transfer it back over onto the heat. You want to move the heat down a little bit. And now basically, what you're basically doing now is, if you've made a white sauce type of thing before ever, which is just, you know, you add the butter, you add some flour, and then you add milk to that. This is basically the same thing, only it's like a sweet version. So what you do is you just sit here and you just keep mixing this to keep it smooth and not lumpy for a while. They say about 10 to 12 minutes. We won't do 10 to 12 minutes necessarily. You just want to wait until it starts thickening, and the flour and the corn flour will start this thickening as it heats up. And you know, you'll be able to feel the consistency. So right now it's very, very, very liquid consistency, and it'll get thicker. So I'll show you what the thickness is like once it's ready. So in the meantime, what I've also done is, what you want to do is you want to pour it into a pastry case. So I just kind of cheated and I made a pastry case earlier. That's over there ready and waiting. You can buy pastry cases from the shops as well. You don't have to necessarily make your own like from scratch. So do whatever is the easiest for you. It's the filling that's the main thing anyway. So
while you're stirring, I guess I alluded to this. You were a Jedi Master. Could you tell us a little bit of how you became a Jedi Master?
So that was another one of these things where CERN was like, hey, we have an idea for you to do something. Let's go do something. Actually, what happened was it was the release of the new Star Wars, and the U.S. mission in Geneva, they were bringing their whole team to the cinema for the premiere of this thing. And then they got in contact with CERN and they were like, hi, don't you guys want to come and do a little, like a little bit of a talk about the forces of nature, you know, cause it's the force and then the forces of nature. So CERN was like, yeah, okay, cool. You know, that'll be fine. Just, you know, do a thing. And then because there's this wonderful woman, Sarah Charlie, who works in the CERN thing, and, you know, she knows me very well. And she was actually in charge of doing all this. And she thought, you know what, we're not going to just go and give a boring talk. We're going to go and do something fun. So she got me and my friend Alex, and we got together, the three of us, and we basically put together a little script of like a Jedi Master and a Padawan talking about the Force and everything in the universe and how this all fits together and the four forces and everything. So then this was really fun. And then we started practicing it. And then Sarah thought, okay, well, why don't we film it as well? So we went underground at CERN. There's all these tunnels that just connect all the different places at CERN. And it looks so cool. And it looks like the bowels of an intergalactic spaceship as well. So we found this really cool place with these pipes going down the side. And it was just perfect for filming. And then that's at the beginning where you see Alex and he's coming down like with his lightsaber down, and we've got it flashing and everything. And that was so much fun. So yeah, that was a lot of fun. Yeah, it was just one of these things. You know, the biggest thing for me is I just keep saying yes to doing these crazy things because they sound like a lot of fun, and, you know, just go where it takes me. And I don't, if I look like a fool, then that's fine. And usually it's a lot of fun in the process. And then, so we did we made this movie, but then we also did at the premiere, we actually got to do it live at the premiere for the US mission people. So that was super fun.
I'm going to ask you another question. Little Mermaid, tell me, why did you choose Little Mermaid? Yeah, I'll have to fill people in here. She released a video late last year, I think, if I remember, where she sang a lovely, well, physics education, but, well, she was Ariel.
I don't know.
I love the girl, right? It's good.
I don't know. I like Disney movies. I like sing-alongs. And, you know, sometimes a thought just pops into your mind. So this one was one actually I've been thinking about for a long time. And then I finally just managed to get all the pieces and all the lines right and everything. When I was writing the theory section of my thesis, Frozen came out. And my kid just loved watching Frozen. We had Frozen on repeat for a long time. So I've also got like, do you want to build a model? Well, I can build a standard model kind of stuff. So, you know, it's sort of a bunch of like life experience and what you're going on. I think with the Little Mermaid, we're thinking a lot now with the European strategy about the next particle accelerator that we need to build after the LHC and how big it is and what type of physics we'll be able to learn from that. And so, yeah, this song was really about, you know, I really just want to see the type of physics that is available, you know, far, you know, where all these forces are combining to become one and everything. I don't know how my brain works often. It just does things.
I really like it. It's you know, you, as I said right at the beginning, you're not stereotypical, and I think that's a good thing. So,
all right, so we're actually done here, and you can see that it is a whole. It's like a lot thicker now, and you know, it looks kind of gloopy, but then as it cools, it'll set. The one thing that you have to do before it sets is just add a little bit of vanilla essence into it. You could add more cinnamon if you wish. Yeah, why not? There's no such thing as too much cinnamon. And also like just a spoonful of butter, because butter makes everything better. And then just give that a little mix up again, just to get things nice and smooth. And all the way through. Then what we will do is we will just pour it into our pastry shell. So there we go. And this is quite a large mixture, so I usually have a bit left over, which you can put into like muffin tins or something. But there we go. So here, it's a little bit wobbly right now. And what I will do is I just leave this out to cool down for a while, and then I'll pop it in the fridge to fully set. And in a few hours, you've got a milk tart. To decorate, just take some more cinnamon, sprinkle it over the top, and there you go. I will send you a picture when we cut this open so you can see what it actually looks like. But yeah, it's really easy to make, and I like the fact that you don't have to bake it or anything like that either. It's just everything's done on the stovetop, and there you go. So, yay.
Well, Claire, that was a wonderful chat with you. I feel like I've been super educated from one extreme to the other. Your passion comes through, whether it's with particle physics or with cooking. I think you've got multiple skills and multiple options for career paths if particle physics ever falls through. Thank you for your time. And I do hope we have an opportunity to speak again at a future date.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful seeing you again, even if it is via Zoom. And it was great to chat, of course. And bonus, I now have more time to eat later on. Thanks so much. It was wonderful chatting.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please remember to subscribe to get notifications of upcoming interviews. And you can find me on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter at Physics High. My name is Paul from Physics High. Till next time.